So again, welcome. Welcome, everyone. Nice to see you all this evening. So as I mentioned in this series on birthing the heart, I'm going to be doing just a few more talks in this series before I leave in middle March. I wanted to include the Brahma Viharas and just talk a little bit about those qualities of the heart. Since I've already given one talk within this series on compassion, I'll have you go back and listen to that talk at the appropriate time. But I'm going to do two talks on metta, and because we get the word confused. In fact, many people who are, they'll often say, oh, I'm doing metta a lot. Well, there's the practice of metta, which I'll talk about tonight, and then there's the quality or state of the heart, which is love, unconditional love, and that in Pali is what metta represents unconditional love. So we use the practice, the conditioned technique and instruction of the metta practice to come to the state of metta. So those are really two different definitions behind those words. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about the unconditioned component of metta. I'm going to do that in my next talk. But I want to talk about just in getting a sense that the state is intrinsic. It's not a state that you have to nurture in order to become loving, like awareness and some of the other Brahma Viharas, all the Brahma Viharas, really, they're natural states of being in which we are removing the obstructions from which this natural, unconditioned state of love can radiate, you might say. So the poem tonight, by Rilke, where that darkness can be seen as a frightful thing, but in some ways it holds all of light. So too you could think of love in the same way, that love, although very still and therefore somewhat frightful for some of us, we think of it in some forms of trepidation and angst when we think of being still. But that's the still state really is the radiation of those basic qualities within us that we cover over through our conversation, through our storytelling, through our narrative, through all of the ways that we get self-involved and self-interested. All of that way we focus our life in the direction of myself and my needs really stands in contrast to something much greater that surrounds us and is intrinsic to us. And we have to have the courage, and really this is where Dharma practice goes, and being able to test the waters of our fear and see whether the light that is being pointed towards by many of the prophets is there, in fact. Will it catch my fall when I am quiet enough and sufficiently still enough in myself to test and see what is there beyond the noise I make. And so metta practice now is really a practice that moves us towards the sense of unconditional love. And so the practice has at its root a way of looking at life to change its perspective from the way that we are fixed upon life and our ordinary perspective of it. And it begins to alter that perspective through a series of techniques that I will be talking about this evening. So the evolution of metta practice is really first of all, we have to, of course, have an inclination to move ourselves in that direction. Nothing can happen if we don't intend it to happen. And so the first thing that we need to do is think, I'd like to incline my heart towards love. It's not within my range. I don't feel its proximity. It feels very distant to me. I feel dry and somewhat separate and distant. And I'm wondering if this thing called love might be beneficial to me. So I'm inclining myself. I want to know what the journey entails. I want to move in that direction. And of course, all of us need to do that with whenever we have or sense something that could be helpful to us spiritually. That inclination towards that is a very important intentionality that sets the whole tone and movement of that practice. And then what we begin to discover is that how full of opinions we are about everything. I mean, when you start the metta practice, basically, you're full of opinions about everyone. Is it any wonder that the natural state of interconnectedness, of love, of intrinsic stillness that holds all of us, like the darkness holds all of us, can't get through with all of our opinions sort of surfacing moment after moment in every relationship we have? You can see we're dead in the water from those opinionations. And the realm that we live in is a very opinionated realm. You know, you might say it in this way. You can say that the judgments is what we thrive upon. We thrive upon judgment because each time we judge, we set ourselves very incrementally apart from the person we are judging. And that sense of distance gives us a more distinct shape and a more distinct sense of our own character and being. And so judgment is the way we form ourselves, the way we shape the very process of our living situation, of our separation. So we're full of judgment. We're full of judgment. And may I say that just recognizing that fact does little about that fact. And when I was a young student coming up, and the teachers weren't much older than myself, I don't think they had the years of practice sufficient to be able to teach some of these more subtle expressions of mind that we do now. And one of them is judgment. They just said, be aware of judgment. Well, I was aware of judgment, but it never did anything to my judgment. My budget just continued right on through. Until I saw that there was something that I was achieving. There was a value to my judgment. And I began to realize that there's a value to everything I assert, but especially my judgment, because when I can judge you, I know myself better by distinction, by contrast. And so what I was getting out of judgment is me. I was getting my sense of myself. And so of course judgment is going to continue, especially in the damaged psyche that most of us grew up through. We want more distinction. We won't want to melt our shapes into a kind of homogenized sense of oneness. We want distinction. We want to know who we are. And so judgment is the decisive way to do just that. But as we judge, and as judgment hardens, it forms itself into opinion. So you might say that opinions are hardened judgments that have been conditioned over time, over a long period of time. And so they have some history with. Now, you look at opinions and you think, well, what's the value of opinions? Well, the values of opinions, this culture loves opinions. In fact, it thinks that you're more clear when you have a lot of opinions. The more opinions you have, the clearer you are. And so opinionation is the way that we have kind of formed the knowledge of our life, our living situation, the duration of our history, all of the experiences we have. We form all of that into an opinion. It can be opinion, political opinion, or opinion about anything. But once it solidifies out of our history, out of our repetition of judgment, out of the way that we are sort of set up in our posture to the living situation. And so we're very proud of our opinions, and we will dispute and hold on, contest those opinions, and we will often try to group and associate with people who have like opinions of our own. So opinions are extraordinarily important as well, and they remain within our psyche because they're honored, not only by us, but by those who form similar opinions. The problem is that opinions are really as varied as the number of people that are alive, and so you're constantly running up against people who have contrasting views. And when you do that, you have a contention on your hands. It doesn't matter because you're right. They're wrong. So you just find your right group of people to be with, and it's obviously not this group. And on you go. Now, so judgments are hardened, or opinions are hardened judgments, but then there are hardened opinions. Opinions that become so justified, so basic to our psyche, it's so that there's such an inclusiveness to this set of opinions I'm about ready to talk about, that they even form us into tribes, you might say, of people that have this quality and people that don't have this quality. And so when opinions harden in that way, in a tribal kind of sense, we get prejudice. We get prejudice. Prejudiced are often grouped opinions that are shared by a similar folk, people who in some way or other share a common trait, sometimes skin color, but often other traits as well. And as that tribe begins to form itself into a solidity, then the prejudice towards other groups that don't have that inclusive quality that our group has is seen as less than. And so prejudice are, again, this grouping, really insane grouping, not based upon anything but sort of the self-privilege of whatever that accommodating quality is in that group. And it's really tribal in the sense that it has to do with group cohesion more than anything about who we're pointing our fingers at. It has to do with staying in a kind of group cohesion. And that seems to be very important to our species. So that is the way we perceive life. We perceive life through judgment, we perceive life through opinions, and we perceive life through our prejudices. And we have grown up with those, and we remain very loyal to those. And then along comes this thing called metta. And metta, practice, the practice of metta, is really a practice which tries to break down judgment. Ultimately, it moves towards breaking down opinions, and perhaps it will even touch upon the prejudice factor. But it starts with just simple judgments that we have about one another. And it does so in a very beautiful way. It has us simply look at what we think about the other person in groups different categories. It has us look at those categories. Now, we're not looking at those categories as being the isolated example of people who we like or have been beneficial to us or are friends. We're not trying to just have a very limited number of people who have free access to our hearts. It really has to do with breaking down the way we isolate ourselves in terms of our distinction and isolate others in terms of the judgments we have about their distinction. And so what it's getting at, where it's moving us, where it is asking us to go, is counter to the cultural imperative of having opinions, which is very strong. And that's why we may be very good momentarily and freeing ourselves of the judgment that I have of you, my friend, or you, my difficult person, or my benefactor. But as soon as we stop that and go outside, we raise all kinds of hell with the car that honks its horn at us, or the person who spills garbage on the road, or the one that doesn't look friendly to us, or the one that's outside of the troop and tribe that we belong to. And I think that people put too much emphasis on this momentary practice of metta without the intentionality to sustain the perceptual shift where this practice is taking us. Because it is a perceptual shift where this has to go. Not a momentary relief from the judgments I have at hand. When the next moment, those judgments will come right back and resurface themselves. And the intentionality has to be towards that end, towards the shift of perspective that I have towards all beings, towards everyone that I have an opinion of, which, if you include the neutral human being, which I have no opinion of, is all beings, isn't it? See, this is where we find ourselves. This is the starting point of metta, is the fix we're in. It's not pleasant because what we see is how fixed everything is in our life. Now, in Buddhism, we talk endlessly about impermanence, but impermanence is often another fixed opinion. It's like, you know, just wait out this moment because it too shall pass. That's a fixed opinion about life and how it's going to move. What it's really intending for us is to move into the fluidity of itself. Not to see life in terms of fixed things, you and me, this and that. But it's calling forth that shift of opinions as well. And when we work with impermanence, we have to work within the influence of that movement, within the influence of fluidity. Not stand outside of it and judge life as moving and soon it'll be okay, which is how many people, many of us do it. This is always involved. It's always a total embodiment of involvement. Buddhism is always, you're throwing yourself in the pool. You're not standing at the edge and commenting upon the other swimmers. We're diving right in this thing. And this fluidity of life, we begin to see in virtually everything we do. Everything we fix, everything we know, most readily in other people. Why most readily in other people? Because it's most assuredly fixed in ourselves. And because those who are most similar to ourselves are going to get the reprimand, the overflow of our own judgment about ourselves, you too are a human being, and therefore you must also be. On and on it goes. So we're up against a lot here when we take on metta. It's not a simple, may I be happy, may I be free, may I be happy, how my life beads out. You know? You can start it in that way, but you're at the edge of the pool here. We need you to dive in. And I'm not going to let you forget that point throughout these Brahma Viharas. This isn't safe territory. This isn't a practice that calls for, an self-isolation. It really calls for, if we're going to connect, which is what the point of metta is, then the way we connect is to become fluid, not to become stationary. Well, I never used to like you, but I've been doing metta, and now you're okay. That's at the pool's edge, right? See this? So what does it look like when we begin, you know, to move closer to this thing, to really let it impact us? Yeah, enough safety in this. Enough of that. And always be aware that the old conditioning is really only a moment's thought away. As much as you invest in the fluidity of the perspective of fluidity, the next time you think a self fixed thought, the next time you use I, the sense of I, you're fixing the life again. Life is eventually the perspective of the thought you're having. That's the form it takes. It takes the perspective of the thought you are currently having. No matter how much metta you've done in the past, as soon as you locate it and fix it with the sense of I or the sense of you, it all comes right back into perspective again as a perspective of self and other. And I just want us to see where this thing really is taking us now. I mean, it's fun to have your heart open to groups of people. It alleviates a lot of self-tension. It makes you feel better about yourself. It allows you to begin to accommodate people who you kept outside your life because of your opinions. It begins to have you really look and see what an opinion is, to have you investigate how we form the judgments that keep us so distant from life. And all of that is very beneficial, and I don't want to in any way say that it's not. It just is still at the pool's edge. And this is about swimming. This is about really altering ourselves, moving towards the truth. Now, if this is all fictitious, if this is all make-believe, I want nothing to do with it. I'll remain at the pool's edge. But some of us in the room know that it's not foolish and that it does hold the truth, and therefore are calling forth all of us to take the chance and see for ourselves whether this might hold a new perspective for us all. So these frozen relationships we have, this sense of, you know, you constantly collide with the same thoughts about someone. You know what they are, who they are, what they have said. You have a summation of who they are in your life. And that's a tough nut to crack. Look at your significant others in your life. That's really the toughest nut to crack. And you can see, there's not too much new that gets in there. There's not really too much vibrancy, too much aliveness that occurs any longer. Because everybody's frozen in the opinion of the other. And this is especially true in terms of ourself. That's why the hardest expression of metta is the one that is turned towards ourself. It's the one we have the longest and most emphatic judgments about. Well, yeah, so I might be wrong that you're the person I think you are, but I know who I am. I know that I'm a fill in the blank, and usually a negative fill in the blank. And I've lived with myself, so don't try to pretend or say that I'm not. And when we have that hardened sense of ourselves, there's no way to get in. You can do metta a long time before there's any real fluidity that shows itself. You see? And this constant sense of self-reprimand I was speaking about in terms of the meditation before we get on. All day long you do, or you have the intention to really be self-accepting, and then whack, you crack the whip of your own self-criticism, and you're right back in that old conditioning again, frozen there. It's like, what was all that about? These have to be challenged, these places of frozen identity, a fixed sense of reference, self-reference. We have to move into those, not just bypass them by saying good things about ourselves. Saying good things about ourselves is one avenue towards that end, but it requires other avenues too. The avenue of knowing what an opinion is, having experienced opinions, but also knowing how they form, seeing them in ourselves, And knowing after you do that, that there is no, there's no one opinion that's better than another. All opinions are essentially equal. How can I say that? Because it's true. Likely if you lived with the person who has the contrary opinion, you would have their opinion, not your own. And so it was a matter of circumstances that gave you the one you have. And they're just ideas. And no actual expression of life holds an idea. It's much more than any idea. And to limit what life is by an idea, through an idea, is so partial, so incomplete, it's not even worth mentioning. And yet our ideas at the same time, even though they're just the barest perception formed from the barest, most superficial expression of life, they hold that entrenched, fixed view, because at the other end of that expression is me. And now by knowing myself, by having that opinion, I know myself. And now it's no longer superficial in the way we hold it. It's revelatory. But as we move through this, you see, and that's what, so the first stage of metta is to understand where we're starting, is to understand the nature of our fixed responses, of the prejudice that we all have and hold, of the opinions that are universal, and the judgments that are moment to moment, to take an inventory of how out of sight of metta we live. That's the first true stance of it, not to try to get over it, but to understand how solidly we believe these things. And how all of that solidity, and this is where our hearts genuinely start moving towards a different change of perspective, is through the understanding of how these opinions and judgments and prejudices are formed at the apex of that formation is our adherence and our investment in appearance itself, and how appearance holds everything to us. It holds the entire meaning of life is found within the appearances of life. And that all we're interested in is the forms and expressions of those appearances. Not the wonder and mystery, not the night that holds that wonder and mystery, not the quiet of the night, but the daylight reflection of the objects that I see. And then once we've invested so assuredly in the opinions, appearances of life, then it's very simple to move into the judgments of those appearances and the opinions about those appearances and the tribal instincts that form the prejudice that exclude certain appearances. And it's all based on that, because why? That's all we look for. That's all that gives us meaning. That's all that gives me a sense of stability in myself. It's the only thing that defines me is the appearance of others, you see? And as long as my need is to be self-defined, I have to focus on appearances. And that's why it's so difficult for us to move beyond appearances, because when we move beyond appearances, we feel like we're losing some part of ourselves. Some part of ourselves is being diminished. It is. It's the idea, the image of ourself that's being diminished. Nothing else. What else could be? And that image is only the reflection back of what we invest in the appearances of life. And so appearances hold an unnatural weight. Not unnatural. I mean, the whole journey of meditation, of spiritual journey, is out of the realm of appearances. It's to divest the need to only define life through appearances. So when I say, well, what else is it? You might ask me, what else is there? I mean, okay, so I won't do that, but what do I do? See, we're looking for a new appearance when we ask that question. Some new appearance show itself. You know, maybe I'll have an image of a Buddha, or No. This is to be quiet. And when we see that, when we invest in appearance, along with those, that investment comes the downside of judgment, opinion, and prejudice, then now we're willing, okay, so wait a second here. What's life really look like when I'm not investing my psyche into it? Right? Now, something else comes forward. When we ask that question from sincerity, you sense something. You sense the intimation of metta. Not the practice of metta, but the intrinsic state of metta. You sense not the dissimilarities, but what the common, what there is in common, what is commonly shared. And this is a road in, this is our step in to true metta practice. Is that we have a touch or a sense of where this practice could lead us in changing our perception, in jumping into the pool and changing our perception. And we get quieter because we realize the more we speak about the conditioned appearances that are in front of us, the further that sense of metta is distanced from us. And because there's a tremendous allure to that state, that quality of undefinable love, we want to get quiet and encourage it forward. And so now we're operating the system in a way that's truly helpful. Not trying to get over our judgments and over our opinions. It's just fine at a certain level. But believe me, as long as we remain tied to the sense of I and you, the sense of separation, judgments will follow. Opinions will be, because that's the way the mind works in that shop, in that realm, in that paradigm. And though we can quiet them for a while, not for long. And so the question is, you know, what do we want this journey to be about? And so we take on these categories with that are increasingly difficult. It starts with a benefactor who I can open my heart to and don't have a lot of judgment about. And next it moves to a friend in which friends are friends. You know, there's some good and bad there. The next person is the neutral person who I don't have any feelings about whatsoever. Imagine a person that who is completely outside of yourself. At least the person who you have difficulty with is an outside of you. But the person who you do not know or even care about, there's no caring connection to. To me, that's the worst category of all. Because we don't even include them in the human race. We don't even care about them enough to include them in our tribe. And then there's a difficult person. There will always be difficult people because we have difficult areas of ourselves, and we keep projecting those areas of difficulty onto others when they show that trait. And then we keep contracting to what we see in the other because we dislike that particular quality in us. And so as long as the self hasn't been fully brought into our hearts, there will always be that distinction, that contrast, that definition, that judgment that shows itself again and again through our perception. No way around it. And the hard work is sort of digging into that stuff, not trying to gloss it all over, pretend it's not there, but digging right into it. Let's look at this thing. Why is it that I am this of this age and I still feel this way about myself? You think it's going to change on your deathbed? Yeah, get serious about this. Let me see here now. And this, now we're moving into the common quality. We're still seeing appearances, but the rub, the emphasis on appearances is being lessened. So the heart is melting. See, this is the evolution, the perceptions, the evolution of perception. And the evolution of perception, when intended, moves towards love. When intended, it moves in that direction. And so the softening of distinctions means we're going to get quieter, because distinctions are formed by the noise of my mind, my judgments. And if I get quieter, there's going to be less judgment. And so people are going to feel more, they're going to feel of equal worth, the common humanity. And now I'm not so focused on what color skin you might have or your gender, because that seems so irrelevant to the common, to what we have in common, to what unites us. And the more I'm willing to surrender to what unites us, the more my heart comes out and connects with others. And that feels good. And that compels me to do more, compels me to move forward. And so when we finally get to the phrase, all beings, we have now stepped into a new form, a new melting phase of our hearts, a further extension, less dominated by and through appearances and judgments, where even the distinction of the common human being is not the focus, but the fact of all sentient beings. All sentient beings. So I was listening, maybe some of you caught it today on one of the public radio stations. There was a story of the Department of Agriculture. I just caught the last part of it, so I may not be representing it as well as I think, but the last part of it was about how the Department of Agriculture handles animals in the complete inhumane way through this man's examples who did research on this, where, you know, they're not completely anesthetized and they're squirming, and the people who are sawing them up as they're squirming just are kind of laughing and joking, almost as if that the life, the expression of life ends with the human being. That there's no common linkage between that pain that the pig or cow is showing and the pain that I have and feel as well. And or monkeys or rats. But when this sense of metta starts moving beyond the boundary of simple human beingness, which means that there's been a lot of work a lot of self-work, remembering that my expressions of how life is, my judgments always come from my own resources, from my own mind's projection. And so there's been a lot of work on self, of seeing, of healing, of crossing the divided mind. Then, what comes out, the next melting point, the next stage of the heart's evolution towards true metta is all beings, which can be reinterpreted as all parts of myself. You see? May all beings, may all expressions of myself, because that's really what we see. We see expressions of ourselves and other beings. That's how we identify. And when we're in that expression of open-heartedness, we're all beings, then there is a true healing. No longer in connection, but in interconnection. No distinction made. That there can be the angst, the feeling of empathetic response to the smallest creature's pain as there is to the human being. And now you begin to see the movement of the practice of metta into the very state of metta. And it gets worrisome to those of us who like our sense of self-formation, because you can't sustain that movement toward metta and sustain yourself along with it. One or the other has to go. One or the other has to be released. And in meditation and spiritual journey, we never ask you to release anything that's authentic. I will never ask you, nor any teacher, nor any textbook, authentic textbook, will ever ask you to release what's authentically yours. It will only ask you to release what's inauthentic. And so you see that if it were an authentic you, you wouldn't need noise to support yourself. That the fact that you are supported by something means you are dependent upon that for your image, for the very manifestation of your image, and therefore it's inauthentic and can be released. And so we do. And this takes us to the next stage. Because the mind's formation still is dwelling upon appearances in the previous stage of all beings, all sentient beings, all beings. But there is a stage in which all, the totality of life is loved, in its totality, in form and in formless, and all expressions of form, the ones that we claim are inanimate, the rocks, the trees, the sky. And we begin to sense the uniformity of all consciousness. And now we have moved from connection in stage one to interconnection in stage two to oneness in stage three. And it's simply the willingness to follow that sense of metta, that cord, that line of metta. Like the scent, strong scent to a dog. Knowing the course I'm on and just finding through all obstacles your way forward. You now sit in the quiet of uniformity, not homogenization, not a life without appearance, a life that's not directed by appearance, that isn't formed from appearance. Green doesn't become, all colors don't become white. Distinctions can still be seen, but they no longer direct one's life nor one's mind in that way. So do you want to come? You see the question? Come on. It's time. Let's jump into the pool of metta.